Come on, hit me with the bass. Thou shalt keep an open mind.
In a world where only the strong survive, there comes a time when the only way to settle the score is a one-on-one battle to the finish. Two entrepreneurs enter, but only one of them leaves. It's the Entrepreneur Showdown with Joe Cassandra and Dan Franks. Now, on to the showdown.
Hey, everybody. Happy Monday morning. I hope you had a great holiday, whatever that holiday you celebrate might be. And we're headed full steam towards the new year. 2014 is right around the corner. And thanks for joining us on the very final edition of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast of 2013. I am Dan Franks. Coming on in just a little bit, my partner in crime, Joe Cassandra. And today we're going to get into a little bit of goal setting talk in round one. It's not going to be all about goal setting, but we'll get there as well. But it's an article by Nick Loper from Side Hustle Nation talking about the 10 commandments of side hustling. So you'll want to stay around for that. Then in round two, we're looking into the future, not just 2014 future, but let's look into 2020. So we're looking a few more years down the line, but we're going to look at 7 trends for the future of work to 2020. And the author of this article will be joining us as usual in the main event, Rob Rawson. Rob is famous for starting Time Doctor and Staff.com, and we're excited to talk to him in the main event about trends for the future of work. We're talking about virtual work. We're talking about technology improvements, maybe even some robots or artificial intelligence coming into the conversation. So it's a little bit strange episode here to finish up 2013, but we're excited to share it with you. And remember, for the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more, you can head over to entrepreneurshowdown.com. And by the way, if you're coming to New Media Expo this coming weekend, 2014 in Las Vegas, Nevada, look us up. Tweet us at Showdown Podcast or DM Franks or Joe Cassandra. All three of our Twitter handles you can reach out to us at. Hook up with us. We'll be there. We'll be shaking hands. We'll be kissing babies. Don't bring your babies to Las Vegas if you're listening to this before New Media Expo. Anyways, I wanted to tell you guys that in case anyone's out there and wants to give us a shout. But without wasting any more time, let's get on to the showdown.
Round one.
Today in round one, Joe and I are looking at an article from Side Hustle Nation, which goes along with the Side Hustle Show, which is a podcast hosted by Nick Loper. And I think that's where I heard about Nick first was when we were in New and Noteworthy. Nick was up there as well. So he and I and you, we all kind of started about the same time with these podcasts. But the article we're looking at right now is from SideHustleNation.com, and it's called The 10 Side Hustle Commandments. Are you on board? And, you know, he breaks down these 10 things that he says you must, I guess, 10 commandments you must follow to be a good side hustler. And, you know, to me, the side hustle, it's doing something like we're doing. I feel like kind of what we're doing is that side hustle. We're doing one thing full time and then we're doing all this other stuff on the side. So I think maybe these are commandments you and I should be following, Joe.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. He's got a picture of Moses, too, as there, which I thought was cool because I love that movie. But
yeah, I think it's a real picture of the real one, the real guy.
Yeah, I thought they did have cameras back then. I thought they did. he has a couple good ones. One that I've talked about before that I like is you need to take time for yourself and make sure.
Hold on, you got to say it in 10 commandment style. What's the commandment?
The 9th commandment.
Thou shalt take time for yourself. Okay, proceed.
You got to put the deep voice in it. Thou shalt take time for yourself. But he talks about scheduling time to be creative and relax a little bit because everyone always wants to be up and about. And I know sometimes, like, if I'm just like relaxing, you can get a little antsy because you feel like maybe you could be using this time to do something else, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you need to just take the time to breathe, and he even says to breathe.
All right, well, come on, Joe. This is one of the least important commandments. That's why it's number 9. Let me take over and come back to
that's an important one.
Well, let me talk about the one I like the most, and come on, hit me with the bass.
Thou shalt keep an open mind.
So what that means to me is, like, be willing to kind of think outside the box, be willing to take criticism. And hey, you and I were just talking before we started recording about one of our more recent round ones with Mark Guberte, where he came out and he had this tactic for getting more Twitter followers. And I came on round one that day and said, hey, I think his tactic is kind of spammy. I don't really see any value in doing what he is doing. But you and I talked about it a little bit after we went off the air too. And I decided, heck, you know, I'll go ahead and give it a shot. And we'll link to the episode in the show notes if you didn't hear this discussion. But I went ahead and I followed some of these tactics. And while I was kind of trading followers for following people, so I wasn't really, I guess,
Does that mean?
Well, I was trading followers for following. So I would follow somebody and they would follow me back. So I was trading a follow for followers.
Okay.
Right. So that's the tactic kind of is, you know, you follow a lot of people and hope that a lot of people, those same people kind of follow you back.
Yeah.
Something like that. So that's what I did. And, you know, I felt spammy while doing it. But then what came of it was I was actually making real connections with some of these people that I would have never connected before. And I think we tried this a little bit on the Showdown podcast Twitter as well. And we started making connections with people that said, hey, I've been listening to your show. Thanks for the follow. Like, so we're actually making connections with some of our audience who, for whatever reason, we had never connected with this before. So, you know, here's this tactic that originally I thought it was kind of spammy, but it turns out we're reaching some of our audience members that we never even knew existed. So I kind of turned around on it because I kind of kept that open mind and started thinking outside the box and being okay with maybe pushing my own inner limits a little bit. It turned out to be pretty good, and I'm starting to come around on it a little bit.
Well, that kind of goes along with the third one, which is thou shalt experiment. And that's something that we've done, but also it's kind of can be a crutch too, because you want to try so many different things all at once. And we've just had this discussion, but when you try and do so many things at once, you're not going to end up doing one thing really well. So, like, for us, we were testing out Facebook ads, testing out the Twitter thing that you mentioned, and then a bunch of other stuff as well. And we weren't really seeing too much fruition out of all of them. And if we had just focused on, say, just this Twitter strategy, then we may be a lot farther along than where we are right now, because we're doing all these other things, because we're experimenting with all. So yeah, you should experiment, but you also got to know where to not experiment and know that, hey, trying ideas is great, but you got to make sure you try one or two at a time and make sure that if that's the right way to go, then do it. And if not, then you need to not, I guess, overload your plate, which is what we did.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it's focused experimentation. So if if we were to set out and say, okay, our goal right now is to get more Twitter followers, and that's our main goal we're focusing on, then you can do all kinds of experiments within the realm of that goal. So I think in that terms, you don't really have to throttle back on the experimenting. You just have to be more focused with your experimenting. So I think that's kind of what you were saying.
Yeah.
But another one that I thought that was pretty interesting was, and let me get my deep voice going again, was commandment number 5, thou shalt make meaning and money. So this is kind of goes back to that, you know, is it something that should we be doing things that we like, or something that's good for our audience? And this to me kind of wraps it up. You should be doing something for both. So if you can find some kind of work, some kind of side hustle, as Nick would say, that you enjoy doing, or it gives you gratification and you fulfillment, and that in turn, it also satisfies some kind of need for the audience or something for the customer. And it's mutually beneficial for everyone. But that's a huge positive for any side hustle, is if it's something where everybody wins. It's not spammy. No one's getting ripped off. No one's getting taken for a sucker, but everyone's benefiting. So that's a big one in my book. And the last one I want to talk about, Joe, and this is because of the date of this release, we are only a few days from 2014. So this is thou shalt keep your goals in mind. And this is a big goal setting time for everybody in the year. In the next few weeks, people are going to be setting a lot of goals. So one of the biggest things is people always want to set goals this time of year. But come March, April, May, June, July, once you start getting the long months of the year, the long hot months, if you're here in Texas with us, a lot of people kind of lose sight of those original goals. And I think it's very important to, whether you're writing down your goals or keeping track of them somehow, to revisit those goals from time to time so that you don't lose focus. And maybe if you put forth a lot of effort during your goal setting process to make sure, hey, these are real goals. These are sustainable goals. These are things that are, I'm not just putting on paper because it sounds cool now, but these are things that I can really see myself pursuing for the entire year, for quite a bit of the year. Then maybe once you look back on them when you're in the middle of the year, and if you strayed from them a little bit, you can kind of remember why that was so important at that time, and hopefully kind of put yourself back in that mindset you were in then.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about some of the goals we have in the mashup. I think it was the second one. Was it the second one? I think it was.
Yes.
We're not going to tell them. We want you to go listen to it. So you're going to, we'll link to the show and you'll go listen to what we said about it. So we're not going to spoil it for you here, but that's one thing that we'll be focusing on in the beginning of the year is have specific goals. And this is going back again to the testing ideas, but to have specific goals and then focus on each one of those one at a time or two at a time, but very minimal, not spreading ourselves thin like we already have, and see if, okay, if this is the path, if that's going to help us get to the next level or whatnot. And just going, but by the time this release will it'll be ripe for the new Media Expo, where we're hoping that meeting a lot of new people and maybe a lot of new listeners, that'll jolt us to the next position up the ladder, closer to some of the goals that we have for the end of the year that we mentioned in the mashup that you'll have to go listen to. So, we're hoping 2014 will be a big goal reaching year.
Well, there's a big, important piece of a side hustle right there, goal setting and goal committing. And we want to thank Nick Loper for these 10 side hustle commandments. You can check out the article in the show notes at entrepreneurshowdown.com. But now let's get on to round two.
Round two.
In round two today, we're looking at an article by Rob Rawson, and we'll have Rob on in the main event. But he recently wrote a post on staff.com, which is one of the companies he founded, called 7 Trends for the Future of Work in 2020. And right now, as of this recording, it is 2013. So he's got 7 years for all this to come to fruition. But he's a big outsourcing guy. And so a lot of this article is focused on how work is going to be outsourced or automated or whatnot. And one thing that I thought was really interesting is one of them, he talks about anything that can be automated will be automated. So a lot of things that are very basic manual type labor, and I'm thinking of fast food, of any type of, I guess, small machinery type things that a person has to be there to watch over or whatever, all that type of stuff, he's saying is going to be automated just by robots. Robots are going to take over and do all that. And it kind of makes you a little wary about, okay, then where are all these other people? Where are they going to have work and whatnot? And he's saying, hey, you just got to figure out ways to stand out from the pack, and you got to build something that'll provide value to other people, because a lot of this stuff that people bank on, these easy type jobs, are soon going to be taken over by machines pretty much.
Yeah, as you mentioned, his whole philosophy, especially in this article, is that people are going to be replaced by machines, and the people that are currently doing jobs, basically those jobs are going to be getting taken away from them and replaced either by those machines or by other people, you know, that will do the work cheaper, maybe even better and cheaper. But this specific one you talked about, yeah, he mentions the computers or robots or machinery taking over for a lot of the jobs that right now involve a lot of manual labor, which means people have jobs. And one of the examples he points to is, well, 200 years ago, 70% of American workers were in the agriculture business. They were working on farms or on the ranch or whatever you want to say. Whereas now only kind of 1% of those people fit into that category. So that's one of his big examples that, hey, this happened before, so it can happen again. But you know, sitting from where we are right now, it's like, okay, well, yeah, that was 200 years ago. There was no technology or anything like that. So these jobs just kind of shifted to people doing other things. But sitting here right now, it's like, well, where else is there for these jobs to shift? And like you, I know he said, and you mentioned that, hey, you just got to be creative and start doing different things. But I don't know. Like, to me, eventually it's like something's got to give. Something's going to run out somewhere. Is this just going to cause a huge decline in population over the next, you know, few, whatever, centuries or decades because of this? Because there's no jobs. So like in China, for instance, they don't have the resources to handle the population growth. So they started putting restrictions on children, you know, the ability to raise a certain number of children. I think it's limited to one right now that each family is allowed to have. And then I don't know if they snip the tubes or tie the tubes or whatever you do to forcefully enforce that. But yeah, I mean, it seems like if there's not enough jobs to go around, eventually it's just going to create all kinds of destitution and poverty and kind of force people's hand to do stuff like that.
I think this could actually be helpful. I know in the short term, a lot of people probably struggle because they're used to, and especially in America now, I think more people are a lot more, when you expect a lot of things without working for it, I forget what the privilege or whatever that, type of thing. I think a lot of people are a lot more privileged. Well, if you look at when just this country was founded, and no, it wasn't perfect, and I'm sure history brushes over some rough spots, but a lot of people, you had to pretty much be entrepreneurial. You had to find ways to make money or to provide value to others, and with trading, learning how to negotiate with marketers and everything like that, you had to figure all that out. And that's how this country was built. And we've kind of, a lot of people there, they're now just used to living in front of the TV and just letting sometimes the government take care of you. And I think something like this, it's kind of like separating the wheat from the chaff. It's you're saying, okay, if you don't have anything, if you don't have any value to provide, we're taking all those easy jobs where that you've been banking on, we're taking those away. And of course people are going to whine and complain about it and ask the government to help out. But if it saves money, especially if it saves a lot of companies a lot of money by just installing these robots that can do something for 24 hours instead of having to pay someone even more for just the 8 hours of window, then it's going to make people have to start thinking more outside the box and actually get that survival instinct going again. And some people need that. I know sometimes I need that if I want to push start some sort of project or something. Sometimes I get lenient because I know, okay, I work during the day, and so I have that money coming in, and so I don't really need to rush any type of project going forward. And sometimes you need that urgency to keep going.
Yeah, well, you know what? I want to switch gears a little bit and get away from some of this doom and gloom and talk about some of these other points he made that might just be more evolutionary points and not necessarily things that maybe are foreshadowing the end of the world as we know it. And that's probably a little extreme, but that's how I take it sometimes. But he talks about the virtual online workplace becoming more mainstream, which he actually has personal experience doing this. He had an office with a lot of employees there, and he found it to be more of a hindrance than anything else. And so all his businesses now are completely virtual. People are working in, I think one of his companies, 8 different countries, his 20 employees are working from, and they're all working, you know, cohesively as a unit, just as if they were in the office next door to one another, but it's all virtual. And he talks about some of the virtual collaboration tools that are more or less taking the business world by storm. You know, Skype, a lot of people in our podcasting space and some online businesses have used Skype and tools like it for quite a while, but now it's becoming mainstream in all businesses. You know, brick and mortar businesses are now using Skype to keep from having to fly across the country for meetings and stuff. So I think this is one of the benefits to this evolution. I think these are good things that we're coming closer and closer to this 2020 deadline he's got on this article.
Well, it's a lot of technology is taking over, and you kind of got to find your spot and where you can stand out. And it'll be interesting to talk to him about it and what he thinks about a lot of virtual workplaces and everything like that, because a lot of older companies that have been around since before this technology has arisen are usually going to want to hold on tight to the old fashioned sit in a cube all day and whatnot. And it may be hard to kind of convert those type of companies, and we can ask him about that, his thoughts on that. So let's get to Rob in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
For the main event today, we have Rob Ross. And Rob came from making seven figures in online marketing to building staff.com and Time Doctor. Previously a medical doctor, he traded in his scalpel for startups and travels the world managing his virtual team. And we now have him on the showdown. Rob, how you doing today?
Fantastic. It's really warm down here in Australia right now.
Well, believe it or not, we're in Dallas, Texas, and it's the 1st of November, but it's actually very warm here as well. So we're lucky with our weather right now.
Awesome.
There you go. We love it. Well, usually before we get started, we usually like, instead of going through backstories, we like to just ask if you had been on a podcast or any other show recently that you tell your story really well.
I've just been on the Entrepreneur on Fire podcast, which was released recently. So that actually tells the story pretty well. And so they can go through that if they want to know my personal story.
Nice. And it's very interesting how he goes from all his online stuff, and now he's doing something completely different. So for the article that we just talked about, we talked about it in round two, seven trends for the future of work to 2020. Now it's 2013 right now, so we got 7 years before any of this is going to take place. And you think a lot of work is going to start being outsourced, and especially just, I guess, like easy work, like fast food type stuff. You think robots are going to take those over and there's going to be tons of people unemployed. Is that correct?
There is a chance that there's going to be this economy that is lacking in actual jobs. I know it's a scary thought in a way, because we're used to in the West having so many jobs, but as technology does become more efficient, people have to transition to a new type of work. So they've got to really think about what are the things that cannot ever be done by robots. And so those are the sort of jobs that won't be transitioned. But there's still a lot more to be taken over by technology.
So for, I know we talked about it before, like at least in America, as that's where we grew up. A lot of people, I guess they kind of get into their comfortable life and their easy type job, just making money and then going home to just watch TV or whatever. While when the country was first like being built, a lot of people had to be entrepreneurial, and that's how our country was founded, by pretty much entrepreneurs. They built it up. And so you're saying this is kind of maybe like it's cleaning out, it's like a re-cleansing, and everyone's going to have to be entrepreneurial again. Do you think that's the case?
I think there's a part of it like that. I think that you don't know what your next job is going to be. You have to be a little bit more entrepreneurial to try and figure out what it can be.
So if that's the case, like expand on that. What do people need to start doing if they're in a job that maybe a robot could do, but it's something they've always done? You're saying they need to start preparing to make that shift to plan B?
Yeah. And it's probably not just the robots. It's more the artificial intelligence applications that are going to be the real. It's things like bookkeeping work. So if you have an application, a computer application that can automatically do a lot of the bookkeeping work, and that's, we're starting to see that already with different applications that are coming online. And so that's really interesting. But people in that type of work, even knowledge work, is going to be pushed out by computers. It's just going to happen gradually in some cases, and it's going to happen dramatically in other cases when there's a really big shift in technology. It may also not be just to 2020. It's really take a bit longer for the full trend to be realized, because artificial intelligence is not yet fully able to replace jobs. But in 20 years or 30 years, you're going to see a massive shift in that area.
So Rob, there's a lot of science fiction movies out that talk about all these robots and artificial intelligent creatures kind of backlashing against the humans that created them. Is that something we should prepare for? And I'm saying that somewhat as a joke.
Well, I don't think it's impossible. Let's put it that way. I think it's really unpredictable to say what's going to You can guess, but you can't know for sure because there's so many uncertainties along the way. But I think that's definitely within the realms of possibility.
Well, you made a point earlier about the thing you need to do is look for jobs that can't be automated or maybe can't even be outsourced. Do you have any specific jobs that you have in mind that people will just always have to do and you just can't turn it over to robots? Because you talked about bookkeeping, which I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago, people would think, oh, there's no way you can't have some kind of human categorizing all these transactions. But now you just mentioned that's slowly going, you know, by the wayside. What do you have in mind that might be evergreen?
Well, in the area of bookkeeping, I think it's going to be more towards really high-level accounting work is not going to go away in at least the next 20, 30 years because it's not going to be something that a computer can think around those different issues. So it's anything that's more rote in the type of work, that's going to be replaced. So anything that's repetitive, that sort of issue, that sort of work is going to be able to be replaced by computers or machines. An example that can't be replaced would be massage work. For example, you could have theoretically have a robot that massages you, but I think that there's a certain element, a human element, where people want to be massaged by a person, even if a robot can do it. So there's things like that as well.
Yeah, you can't replace the human touch in a massage, that's for sure. So then I guess this, maybe these, you know, this new artificial intelligence or some of these new machines or computers or robots or whatever you want to call them. So they might be replacing work that humans are currently doing, but then to me that would almost create additional work, because then you have to have programmers for those robots and people actually designing what the robots are going to do or what they're going to look like. So I mean, do you see these maybe just a shift in the job opportunities, not necessarily a disappearance of job opportunities?
My honest perspective is that there'll be both, because there is a shift definitely, but because of the amazing efficiencies of the work, for example, you have one programmer, they can program thousands or millions of robots potentially, or maybe a team of 10 or 20 programmers can program the robots. And so literally those 20 people could be replacing 100,000 people's jobs. So 100,000 people have to then find different types of work. So there is definitely a transition period, and then they can find other types of jobs. And in a way, it could be more interesting jobs. It could be more related to travel, or it could be more related to your hobbies. The one thing that's great about this trend is that it is increasing prosperity. So it doesn't have to be that everyone has the same concept of a 9-to-5 job in the future. I think the future concept may be more like this ad hoc kind of, you get a little bit of work here, you get a little bit of work there, but it's still reasonably well paid, make you survive, because the economy is so efficient that it's that you can still do reasonably well even with those ad hoc jobs.
So for, because you do all virtual staffing, you don't have employees that are, I guess, with you, or maybe you have one or two, I'm not sure, but what are the downsides you ever find with not having all your employees in one place?
The thought about downsides is three things, and it's actually interesting because Marissa Mayer, the CEO of Yahoo, actually said that you're not allowed to from home. It's a new directive for her at Yahoo. Mm-hmm. And the downside that she's looking at is, first of all, there's a discipline thing of you just a little bit more, well, I can work or I can't work, and who knows whether I'm really working. So we replace that with a software program that we have, which creates a bit of discipline in the job. The second thing is the collaboration. And in a larger company with maybe 10,000 people, I think that that is a bit more of an issue, that the fact that everyone's in the same location and you can collaborate and talk and have meetings. There's a negatives too, right? Because you also have all of these stupid meetings that waste a lot of time. So I actually think even in a large corporation, the best combination would be partly from home and partly in an office. But mostly you're talking about, and the people on this podcast are probably people with a smaller business, maybe 5 people, maybe 10 people. And in that case, I think it's a lot easier to do it remotely because you don't have as many of these complex collaboration issues where you're really having to organize communication between hundreds of people. only between 5 or 10 people, and the issues are a lot less, and the savings that you have by working virtual are just huge. So it really is worth it for smaller companies, definitely.
So, but just for like you mentioned, a lot of people that are listening, they're in the smaller type business. When you're just starting off, like when you just started like staff.com or Time Doctor, in the very early stages, you needed to have people right there face-to-face discussing ideas, like you said. So this may not be something that you should implement right away, but they should wait a little bit. Is that the case?
No, I wouldn't say that. You don't necessarily need to have meetings face-to-face. I think that's a 20th century notion that you can only meet face-to-face. I think the thing that is very hard to do virtually is to develop a relationship. So that's the thing where you need to work. You need to be face-to-face. You actually need to meet people face-to-face in order to develop a bit more of a relationship. And I think that's important, especially if you have a business partner. But if you're working with a team where you're hiring a team, I think it's less important, and you really can virtually very well using video, audio, text, all kinds of tools that you can use.
I'm glad you brought up the relationship, because that's huge, and that's one of the things that is most valuable that you develop when working next door to somebody for months and months or years and years or anything like that. So how can you maybe try to replicate that to people that you know you'll never meet? For instance, Joe and I have a virtual assistant, Drew, who produces our show for us, and he does a great job, but he's in another country. There's no chance we'll ever meet him, you know, I think, but, you know, we'd love to have him around for a long time to come. And when you have that relationship with somebody, that kind of creates that bond that maybe they want to work for you as much as you want them working for you. So how are you able to kind of replace that relationship or do it virtually?
So what we do is we actually have a chill room in Skype. So we use different rooms in Skype. And in the chill room, anyone can chat about anything. So they actually just talk about, there was an earthquake in the Philippines recently, and everybody was talking about that, obviously, because it's a huge issue for everyone there. And any kind of personal things, sometimes people share about their family and just talking. They might even have some jokes. It's actually a room where they're allowed to talk about anything personal within the team. And it's not that distracting. It's really only like 10 minutes a day, but it's so important because it does replace some of that feeling of the communication. I do feel like our team does have that relationship. They do talk to each other each day, and they do have a certain level of relationship. I'm not saying that it would replace the type of relationship you would have in person. I think it never can, but I do think that you can go a long way towards as far as you can. So you develop as much of a relationship as you can remotely.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. Now, a lot of people, when they think of outsourcing, they think of just almost busy work. And we've touched on that a little bit, but maybe just, admin work or cold calling or answering phones or even some more simple like graphic works and stuff like that. But in this article, you specifically say that you think we'll see an increase in outsourcing of high level knowledge work jobs. Can you explain how that's possible? Because, I mean, a lot of us think that's how can you do that? But you seem to feel pretty confident that it'll happen.
Well, there's a lot of outsourcing within the United States. So it's true that right now, a lot of high-level jobs, it is difficult to outsource it to the Philippines, for example, or to India, because you're not going to find the right people to do it. And there are some people, but often those people already have a team or they have their own business in there, and they're not going to be actually any lower cost than somebody in the United States, those really high-level people in India or the Philippines. But that is changing also. The skills are changing. And I'm also talking, like I say, is outsourcing within the United States, or you might from the U.S. who's actually living in Thailand because he loves to live in Thailand and he's willing to work for $1,000 a month. And that's another possibility as well, because his living expenses are so low there, it's hard for him to get a better job over there. So he goes, well, I'm going to work for $1,000 a month, but he's actually amazing. So there's a lot of different opportunities like that.
So if you're trying to convince someone that, hey, you need to let everyone not work in the office in a cubicle, but let them go work outside at their home or in a coffee shop or whatever, is there Is there any other pitch they use besides just this will save you money from overhead costs? Is there anything else that you use in that argument?
Well, it's difficult when you're already in an office and you're moving to that virtual. So I would look at a combination. So if you have an office and you can hire someone virtually, that's really great. This really applies especially if you live in a high-cost location. So if you live in Silicon Valley, where it's really expensive to hire someone locally, or in New York, or in Sydney, Australia, these locations, it's very difficult to hire anyone from. So you can hire someone from South Carolina who's still really good but wants to live there and doesn't have as good job opportunities, and you can just add them to your team. And then as you start to do that, you'll see the advantages of it, and you may find that eventually everyone becomes remote, or maybe it's a combination of the office and remote. Maybe they come to your local office once a year. It's a flexible situation.
Have you seen studies or that, hey, them working not in this office, but doing wherever they want to work, that it's increased productivity compared to when they were in the office?
There is one study from Stanford University, which was about teleworkers I don't have the actual reference for the study, but I can give it to you later. And it's a study where they actually were working from home, and they did measure the productivity, and they found the productivity increased when working from home.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I noticed in this article that I was a little bit confused about, and maybe you can explain a little more, and that's the concept of geographic mismatches. Can you explain what that means and why that's either a good or a bad thing going forward?
So the idea of geographic mismatches is that you've got certain areas where there's a lot of job opportunities, and you've got other areas where there's no job opportunities. So that's one kind of mismatch. So again, it's like New York, there's a lot of higher level jobs, and there's also other areas within the United States or around the world where there's hardly any local jobs available, but there's still some really great people. So you've got some locations, some cities where there'll be a lot of great people with a certain skill, but there's not as many jobs for those people. And then other cities where there's a lot of demand for that skill and there's not enough people. So it's like this balance of trying to find the right person wherever they are. In the United States, generally what happens is people tend to move to the job, so they tend to just relocate. So it's a lot easier to do that. Globally, you can't do that because you have to get a visa, and there's so many, you know, hassles in that process, and it's very difficult.
It seems like this geographic mismatch is going to leave somebody more or less out in the cold. You know, we've talked about outsourcing to different countries based on ability to do jobs and maybe cheaper pay. And we've talked about machinery and computers replacing jobs altogether. And this geographic mismatch kind of shifting, being able to shift the, I guess, the work to wherever it is, regardless of where the work is based out of. Is all this kind of movement and changes, is this going to leave somebody just completely out in the cold without a job, just kind of with their, I don't know, hands in their pockets and nothing to do?
I want to give an accurate answer to that. I don't want to give an answer that's just like, you know, the optimistic answer. And I think the reality is that it has, to a certain extent. And I think it's already happened. It's not like this is the future. This has already happened in manufacturing. If you look at manufacturing jobs, they've already moved to China and Asia, and it's really hard for, even now with labor in China has increased a lot. So the prices and the costs of hiring someone over there has gone up a lot, but it's still way less than it is. And so that shift is still happening. It's still going to happen in the future. And it's just a matter of getting the right skills, finding the right area so that you can get a job at the end of the day, and that you're not left out in the cold. But are there going to be some people left out in the cold? Yeah, it's the whole evolution of technology over the last 200 years, really, when they started having the textile mills and people who were doing all the hand weaving, they were left out in the cold. So it's like you have to evolve. That's just the way it is.
Well, I don't want to get too philosophical or whatever you would call it here, but Joe and I even talked about this in round two. Like, is this going to be a change almost in humanity? Like, is there some, at some point, is this whole evolution going to cause a decrease in population just out of necessity? I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, anything you care to speak on, but to me, it seems like that would have to be the direction it goes.
So that it has to be less people because there's not as many jobs. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, eventually I would think with the job pool drying up in certain areas, then eventually the procreation is going to stop and there's going to be less people and population might go down because, you know, there's nothing to sustain all these people.
In most rich countries, it's already gone down. So people are having less babies.
So I guess the answer is yes. And we're already seeing it then.
Well, that's a grim prospect, but I guess say you just had a kid, and if they want to start doing something in, like, I don't know, manufacturing or whatnot, should you start pushing them toward, hey, you need to start learning how to code or doing something like that?
Learn how to build
that?
A robot, kid.
Yeah, build a robot.
I think it's a grim future. I really, personally, I have a very optimistic view of the future. And I think this is all about efficiency, and it's all about actually the United States and other countries becoming richer in the future. So I don't see this as a negative. It just means that there's not this simple scenario of getting a job. So I would advise children or young people, I would say, look at how do you educate yourself? That's one thing. Is there's so many ways to get education for free right now, which is amazing. The fact that you can go and get you don't get the actual degree, but you get all of the learning from the degree. You get everything is available free online. And so you have so much available to learn, then there is so much opportunity out there right now in terms of how you can learn. So that's where I would look at.
Well, I want to ask about, this is like maybe a little off topic, but you started off as a medical doctor, but you didn't go into building something for, I don't know, like to make doctors' lives easier or something, a software product for doctors. So what, for some people, they feel like, okay, I have this skill. This is the job I've been doing. So I need to build something around that because that's the only skill I have. How come you didn't have that type of, I don't know, that mindset to want to improve the lives of doctors?
I would like to do a business like that in medicine. The business that I have now isn't related to that, but I think that the skills that I'm using here and the successes that I have here, I can bring that into a medical business later on. So it's just the evolution of where my business took me in this particular direction. But I think that it's not that I tried not to do something in medicine. It's just that that's how it evolved. And I think that it's okay to go in a completely different direction. I actually took that to crazy extremes. I wouldn't take it to the extremes that I've taken it to. For example, in medicine, I actually took a year off and I studied all of these marketing materials from Jay Abraham. I'm not sure if you've heard of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I studied everything from him. And then I decided that I was a marketing expert after reading all of that. And then I basically became a marketing consultant after taking a year off medicine. And that was very interesting experience. It was good for my entrepreneurial evolution, but it was a little crazy as well.
So would you say maybe you didn't see a problem in the medical field because since you were so immersed with it, everything was just habitual at that point. So it's harder to see it than from someone who may be on the outside looking in. That's why you didn't start something right away in like the medicine field.
It's true. And I think a lot of medical software requires starting off in a big way, having a huge budget and because a lot of incumbents in the area of medical software. So it's a bit difficult to start from nothing.
So what would you say to someone like, okay, they're in the the manufacturing business, and they feel that's their only skill, and so they feel like they have to make some sort of business based off of that. And you're a prime example of that. You don't have to do that. What would you say that they need to start doing? Could they just go and start reading books like you did and become an expert in that way?
I think so. It depends on the person's first person. I'm more of not really a book person and more of a working with their hands, then maybe they should learn in a different way. but because you can't learn everything from books, right? It's not only about books, but you can learn a lot from books, and there's so much to learn out there for free. So I would definitely recommend not necessarily even doing a degree. I would recommend just learning something for free and doing it yourself. It requires a certain amount of discipline, but it's free. I mean, you can't complain about that. The fact that you got so much for free, why not just start on it and then see where it takes you?
Well, Rob, speaking of free, I'm sure your medical education was anything but free. What was your specialty in medicine?
I didn't actually specialize. I actually finished and I worked in a hospital. I didn't get around to specializing, so I only worked for 3 years.
Okay, and what did you just kind of do rotations in the hospital, or
I was working in emergency. It was crazy, actually. I was in a country hospital for a while. I was doing locums because it was paid more, and I was only working 1 week a month. But it was really intense because at times I was the only person in the hospital at night, and it was, and I was a junior. It was scary.
Well, Joe and I, something we talk about sometimes, and we've talked about recently a lot, you know, getting close to the new year and things like that, is the whole idea of goal setting. And a lot of times people maybe set out goals or even start a venture and they are okay with the journey. But then once they actually attain the goal, they're like, oh, this is nothing like I thought it would be. I don't like it anymore. Is that what you had, or you just kind of bounced around and found something you happen to like more?
It was more of the latter. I was always entrepreneurial, even during my medical degree. As I said, I took a year off to do a business, and I was starting businesses during my medical. I was very entrepreneurial, and I was looking to start a business. And so it just evolved into that. It wasn't that I was hating it. And it's funny because a lot of doctors actually complain all the time about, oh, you know, medicine is so wrong, and so you have to work so hard. And I don't think they have a right to complain. I think it's an amazing job, but I didn't do it. Strange, isn't it?
It sounds like you kind of still keep relationships with some of the people you were in med school with?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Well, kind of shifting gears back to the article, one of the things you talked about was employees taking work home and home to work. And to me, this is obviously a way for more work to get done if people are able to, you know, do work from home, which you can do almost everything from a smartphone now. But do you think personally that this is maybe contributing to health problems or psychological problems or anything like that? Because I can see this as being completely crazy if you're completely always tied to work and never are able to escape it.
Definitely an issue if you get to the point where you're just checking emails for, you know, 2-3 hours at night and you're looking. So yeah, it can be an issue, and I think that it is for a lot of people right now. They're working too much at home, they're overworking. So yeah, it definitely can be an issue.
Okay, well, one other thing, then the flip side to this, you also mentioned that people are bringing home to work, and I'm not quite sure what that means. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Well, what I was saying is that people use their own smartphone devices at work, and they might surf the web for their own purposes at work. That's true as well.
Or maybe they're trying to escape their children and their kids can get a hold of them 24/7, regardless of if they're away from them physically.
I actually, my brother-in-law probably does exactly that. He goes to the office to escape from the kids with 3 boys, but yeah, definitely.
So do you expect, because your staff is virtual, that they don't have to come into an office, that they have to always be on the clock at all the time whenever you may need something?
No, I don't expect that, actually. It's only for the people where they're working on the service, for example. So if the service is on call 24/7 for that event, if something goes wrong. But for the vast majority, they don't have that issue. So I don't really expect them to work on the weekends. And most of my staff don't work on the weekends. But it's interesting because they do work very, very flexible schedules. And some of them work just 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. And others just work anytime. Like some of them work, you know, 4 hours at night and then, you know, another 3 hours during the day. They have very different schedules. And some of them just catch up on the weekend because they haven't done enough hours during the week.
So how many hours do you expect them to put in each week?
I actually have in the software, we have 160 hours a month, so roughly 40 hours a week. It's a little bit less than that. And so they actually track it in the software that they use, Time Doctor software, and they track the hours that they're doing and they verify the hours as well.
Are you not afraid that if they're so involved in the software that they have ways to beat the software as opposed to someone who's, it might be foreign to them, they don't?
I trust them. And the guys who are working directly with the software, they're the ones who are actually building the software, well, definitely they can do that. And the guys who are really advanced developers, they can do that to an extent, although the software is really good, so it's hard for them to do that and, and to completely cheat the software. But I trust them. It is a balance, and it's not just about that. So if somebody's doing really amazing work and they only worked 120 hours, that's fine. True in theory, but in practice, I tell you, the people who are the most productive are usually the ones who are working really hard and working the long hours. So it doesn't happen very often. I know people talk about the working effectively, and it's not how many hours you put in. And I think that that's true to an extent. It's definitely true that people can put in 160 hours and not get anything done. But I would say that the people who are the most productive and are really, really good, they are pretty much all working quite hard at their job because they have to in order to constantly improve and to do a really great job.
Have you met, I know they probably haven't met each other, but have you met each of them ever in person, or like when you interview them or whatnot, it's all over Skype?
We actually have very disparate teams. So we've got a team in the Philippines, and I actually met with them in each city. So I had to go to 3 different cities in the Philippines to meet with everyone. And yeah, so when I was last out there, I was the one trekking around meeting everyone.
Yeah.
And then in Eastern Europe, we've got guys in Ukraine, in Russia, Bulgaria, all around Eastern Europe. But we met in Ukraine, and my wife's actually from Ukraine, really perfect. So we just went there and we had a meetup there.
Is there a language barrier problem?
Sometimes, but it's not really a major issue. If somebody's talking to customers on the phone, then they need to have perfect English. But most of the time, that's not the case. If they're developing software, they don't need to have perfect English. And their English is generally pretty good. And the guys in the Philippines, some of them do have perfect English. They really have almost, it's, you know, US level English that you don't really notice much of a difference.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious because I know a lot of people listening may be thinking, well, maybe I should start doing a virtual staff, and then they worry about language and time management and who can you trust because it's all over the internet. How do you even know that that person is who they say they are and whatnot? And you're saying that all these are just very minor things that in the long term, you get more benefit out of it than, sure, maybe there will be a one or two guys that take advantage of the system and you just let them go. But in the long run, it's actually better off than having everyone in an office.
I think in a lot of cases, it's better. See exceptions. You got an architectural business. Maybe you need to see your clients. Maybe you need to have an office. You've got a business where you're manufacturing something or you're a painter. I mean, it's a whole different situation. But we're talking about knowledge businesses. We're talking about an internet business. We're talking about virtual businesses that can be virtual, those sorts of businesses. Then I think it makes sense to take advantage of that. And why just think about hiring in your own local area when you can really hire from the entire country and you can get a whole lot more people that you could get access to? Or even depending on the type of job, you might hire in the United States or you might hire overseas. It just depends on the job and where you find the person with the best skills, the best knowledge, and affordable as well.
Well, Rob, we appreciate you coming on. We haven't ever talked about virtual staffing, so this is a brand new topic, and so I'm sure the audience is going to love something fresh and new, and we appreciate you discussing more of it. Where can we get in touch with you if we want to send you an email and just ask you some questions?
Sure, people can get in touch from the staff.com blog or the timedoctor.com blog, so they just go there and contact us page, actually, and just click on contact us. That'll go straight to me. Or it'll get to me.
Love it. Well, Rob, we appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.